The 1996 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 214, The Backslider 10 Years Later, The Vision of the Cowboy Jesus by Levi S. Peterson, with comments by Neil C. Chandler. Please note that because this is a 60-minute session, the last 30 minutes on the second side of this tape will be blank.
I would like to welcome you to this first morning session. We're starting on time, which I have been admonished to do so that the tape recorder doesn't have a long lead before voices are picked up on it. I am also asked to remind you that those of you in this room should be registered and have a name tag on. With that, I will say that I am not Gary Tyer. My name is Cindy Kindred, and I am here to introduce Levi Peterson, who is a professor of English at Weber State University and who will be presenting the paper in this session. Dr. Peterson received his undergraduate and master's degree at Brigham Young University, his PhD at the University of Utah in English. He is the author of a number of books, the most recent of which, Aspen Maruni, was published in 1995. Other titles include Canyons of Grace, The Backslider, the book which will be discussed today, Juanita Brooks, and with that I will introduce Dr. Peterson. His topic is The Backslider, 10 Years Later, The Vision of the Cowboy Jesus, and after his remarks, Neil Chandler will comment. Dr. Peterson.
Good morning. My novel, The Backslider, appeared in a quality paperback edition in November 1986. 10 years later, the book is still for sale in a less expensive mass market version. During these 10 years, a modest degree of commentary on the book has come to my attention through letters, reviews, articles, and personal conversations. I've tried to ingest this commentary, which has been both positive and negative in its nature, with, I hope, detachment and objectivity. Certain elements allow readers their right to like or dislike my book, as their temperament may dictate. Furthermore, I consider even adverse attention to be better than no attention at all. In any event, my purpose in this essay is to summarize what I've learned about my novel from the responses of my readers, and I will particularly address the vision of the cowboy Jesus, which appears to have emerged as the most controversial aspect of my novel. I will briefly outline the plot. Frank Windham, a young Mormon, works on a hay ranch in southern Utah owned by a Lutheran family. In the early chapters, Frank breaks the commandments with a defiant relish. He fornicates with Mary Ann, his employer's daughter, by deceitfully promising to marry her. At mid-novel, Frank is propelled into repentance by the self-mutilation of his brother Jeremy, who cuts off his own penis and testicles and psychotically assumes the personality of a little girl named Alice. Frank takes Jeremy's mutilation as a sign of God's displeasure with himself and undergoes a radical repentance. He sells his horse, saddle, and saddle, trades off his pickup, gives up his deer rifle, pearl button shirts and Stetson, and adopts his mother's tasteless vegetarian diet. He believes himself fated never to marry nor to again have sex with any woman, having in effect become a self-styled Mormon monk. When Mary Ann turns out to be pregnant, Frank dutifully marries her, first persuading her that he and she can live together as brother and sister until their baby is born and its name established, after which they can peacefully divorce and go their separate ways. Frank quickly proves unable to observe his ideal of a chaste relationship with Mary Ann. Furthermore, he gradually falls in love with this supposedly temporary wife. Having been in love with Frank from the beginning, Mary Ann persuades him to regard their marriage as permanent, in return for which she will convert to Mormonism and live according to the abstemious regimen that Frank supposes God demands of the truly righteous. She agrees that they will have sex only in order to engender children. Late one night, a half-delirious Frank again has sex with her, and she, with good reason, fears the self-incrimination which follows this violation of his own stern standards. Despairing of living as he supposes God expects him to, Frank embraces the arcane Mormon doctrine of blood atonement. Although he proceeds with the ceremony of baptizing Mariana Mormon, he firms up his plan to atone for his unquenchable appetites through shedding his own blood. It is at this juncture that he is saved by the vision of the cowboy Jesus, which occurs to him in the restroom of a church where he changes from his wet baptismal clothes. Throughout the novel, Frank has resisted Marianne's belief in a gentle, forgiving God. Now as the novel ends, and it is apparent that he and Marianne are to enjoy a normal married life, he tells her, "Jesus is kind, just like you always said." I began work on The Backslider in 1982 with the idea in mind that I would cast its chapters into the dignified and poetic rhetoric that I esteemed I had achieved in my just-published collection of short stories, The Canyons of Grace. After four chapters, I concluded that my attempt to achieve an impressive style was failing. Quite suddenly, in the summer of 1983, I struck off a new first chapter full of comic incident and cast in a simple sentence structure harmonious with Frank's uneducated thought processes. That fall, I read Douglas Thayer's novel Summer Fire, which narrates in a relentlessly simple style the naive point of view of its juvenile protagonist. Suddenly, short elliptical sentences sounded totally right, and mine now seemed to line up one after another without dissonance. In rewriting, I also made my four existing chapters much more comic and went on from there to infuse the later chapters with a similar humor. Many readers have commented on the comic qualities of The Backslider, which I judged to be farcical rather than witty. Regrettably, the subtle humor of the novel of manners is not one of my fortes. As an author, I will say that the appearance of humor during the act of composition is intuitive and unpredictable. For example, in the later novel, I found myself exploiting the humor in Jeremy's psychotic insistence that he is a little girl named Alice, a possibility I certainly wasn't mindful of while writing the brutal scene in which Frank rescues Jeremy from bleeding to death after he has cut off his penis and testicles. Sometimes I felt an enormous abyss between the suffering Frank and the comic Frank, and I wondered dozens of times whether the two could remain in the same narrative. They did remain together because they had to. My primary interest was in the suffering, penitential Frank, yet I myself could not bear to live with him day after day while composing the novel without the relief that the hard-headed, cross-grained Frank brought me. Some readers have complained that none of my Mormon characters are normal. I readily grant that Frank, Jeremy, and their mother Margaret are not typical Mormons. However, many of my lesser Mormon characters, Uncle Lonnie, Raymond, and Helen, for example, strike me as coming quite close to what you might have expected to encounter in small towns in southern Utah during the 1950s. Is Uncle Lonnie abnormal because he drops his underwear to show Frank the outbreak of shingles on his back, and then drops his underwear further to show him the scar from an axe wound on his buttocks? That came directly from real life, from my very normal sister, who incidentally refuses to this day to read The Backslider, made her very normal husband drop his LDS garments to show me the shingles on his back, and then made him drop them further as an afterthought to show me the long scar on his buttocks where surgeons had extracted a needle he had sat on. A number of my reviewers have commented on the grotesque quality of The Backslider. I assume that none of my characters are grotesque at all moments. The word grotesque certainly wasn't in my mind while I wrote the novel. Still, it is true that a man like Jeremy, who has literally carved a new identity from his own flesh and blood, is monstrous and horrifying. I did not create Jeremy out of thin air. It is possible that I first encountered him inside myself. I know at a very early age that my mother wished I had been born a girl. I was far into adulthood before I realized how profoundly I wanted to accommodate her impossible wish. I never knew anyone like Jeremy in real life. However, I have heard more than once of men who cut off their own sex organs, and Jeremy can also be said to be an attempt on my part to create a plausible personality for a man who could do that to himself. A psychiatric nurse from Brooklyn, a Catholic, wrote me that she found Jeremy entirely believable, except that his language is more coherent than she would expect from a profoundly psychotic person. Frank's and Jeremy's mother, Margaret, is based to some degree on my own mother. My mother wasn't given to dietary excesses, but she was very compulsive about prayer and the commandments. She believed that dreams were revelations, often ominous ones. She once told me she went into the fruit cellar and was seized by a profound despair. She escaped as fast as she could and decided she had had a revelation of the despair the condemned feel in hell. You will perhaps recognize that I attribute this experience to Frank's mother. Some readers have said that the excessive penitence I depict in France is not a Mormon problem, and in dealing with it, I am off track as far as Latter-day Saints are concerned. Mormons, I am reminded, believe in a loving, forgiving God and in a regimen of behavior that promotes rather than denies earthly happiness. Even Frank admits to Marianne that his self-imposed ascetic regimen is not typical of other Mormons. So why indeed did I elect to treat this thing? Because many, many Mormons, though they believe in a gentle God, do not behave as if they do. I was very sensitive to the fact that my mother, who was conscientious and compassionate in the extreme, doubted her exaltation in the celestial kingdom. In early adulthood, I was shocked to read the sermons of Brigham Young and Jedediah M. Grant on blood atonement. I do not need to remind my listeners that blood atonement is an issue even today among Mormon fundamentalists. The point of this doctrine is that Christ's blood does not suffice for the forgiveness of certain sins, for which the blood of the sinner is also demanded. Blood atonement is, of course, an express theme in the Backslider. The fundamentalist Bertha Chittenden reads to Frank from one of the aforementioned sermons, reinforcing his tendency toward self-punishment. I see many signs of unnecessary self-denial among the Mormons. I know a couple of my own age who, upon marrying, debated whether contraception was permitted a married couple and decided it was not. Needless to say, they have raised a large family. A young friend of mine, apparently of the same mind, is having babies as rapidly as she can, even though her home is made hellish by the swarm of children that already exist there. I know innumerable Mormons whose Sabbaths, meticulously observed, are tinged with frustration and boredom. It appears God hates entertainment and pleasure on his sacred day. In her later years, my mother fasted every Sunday of the month. When she was very old, she refused to knit on Sunday, though the boredom of having nothing else to do was a genuine hardship. I have difficulty seeing how anyone who has read Spencer W. Kimball's The Miracle of Forgiveness can believe Mormons are capable of forgiving themselves readily. Despite its optimistic title, that book reminds its readers that sin has to be suffered for intensely. I do not suggest that Mormons have any monopoly on penitence and self-denial. In calling Frank Windham a Mormon monk, I refer to an ascetic tradition as old as Christianity itself, the withdrawal of men and women from the world for the purpose of leading a sparse, devout life. Frank takes license for his penitential behavior from his immediate ancestors, especially his mother and grandmother. Even so, he may be viewed as inventing a mode of penitential behavior that exceeds the pattern of his immediate ancestors. In the passage which I will now read to you, he unwittingly circles around to the medieval Catholic act of self-flagellation. At this point, Frank is in the midst of what he views as a single year of marriage to Mary Ann, struggling vainly to maintain a fully ascetic regimen. It is Saturday morning, and on the preceding evening, he has made love twice to Mary Ann, who has agreed to help him limit his sexual activity to a single evening each week. And so, reading from the Backslider, Frank put on a jacket, went out into the fresh, cold air. The barn and sheds loomed in the dark. A gray rim of morning stretched over the eastern horizon. A horse nickered, a goat bleated, a robin chirped. From Hogan Wash came the faint throb of the diesel which had been pumping water all night. He went into the tool shed and closed the door, groping until he found the wall switch and turned on the light, a dangling bulb. The odor of motor oil filled the shed. Scattered on the concrete floor were wrenches and parts of an engine, a camshaft, gleaming pistons. A head with gaping cylinders. He stretched on tiptoe and felt along a narrow shelf nailed to a joist. He pulled down a tiny notebook, a stubby pencil, and a leather strap. He dragged a stool from the workbench and sat under the light. Opening the notebook, he added two marks to a long roll. Wetting the pencil tip in his mouth, he carefully totaled the roll. 46 marks. 46 times he had had sex with Mary Ann since their wedding day. It frightened him to see how the marks were accumulating because he didn't know how to undo them. They were lining up like pickets in the fences of hell. It was time to add up the good deeds he had performed during the past week, time to see what credits he might have accrued. He had said his secret prayer both night and morning. He had read from the scriptures every evening except Friday. He had been kind to Mary Ann, hadn't said sharp words to her. He hadn't exalted himself because he was foreman and hadn't got mad at Nathan. He and Mary Ann had gone to Panguitch on Saturday afternoon to be with Margaret and Jeremy. On Sunday, he had attended priesthood meeting, Sunday school, and sacrament meeting. He had stopped by the bishop's house and given him a tithing check. Now it was time to tally his shortcomings. He was chagrined, embarrassed, ashamed how he had wallowed in sex, not once, but twice. How he had reveled in Mary Ann's flesh. Furthermore, he had eaten for his belly, relishing every bite of ham, steak, and sausage, savoring hot cakes and honeyed muffins. He had said bad words, son of a bitch, four times, piss once, damn twice, also shit twice. He was loose-minded and gamesome about his driving. More than once, he had caught himself doing 70 miles an hour in the old pickup. He had lusted on his work. One afternoon, he had got all tied up and absorbed with working on the new sheds, later coming awake and realized he hadn't thought about God and spiritual things for 3 or 4 hours. His book wouldn't balance. His checks were written against insufficient funds. No one but Lucifer would cash them. He had a standing order with a broker in one-way tickets to hell. He had a trunk full of them, good any day, any hour, any season. Frank pulled the leather strap from his fist 4 or 5 times. Cut from an old harness, dark with oil and dirt, it was 1.5 feet long, 1.5 inches wide, 1/4 inch thick. Every Saturday morning he gave himself 10 slashes. They were nothing at all, a token of a sign of what he would do if he was free to please God. He went to the door and peered out. Pale light lay over the ranch. Windows were gray in the houses, a calf bawled, a dove cooed. He closed the door, took off his shirt, preparing for Sunday. It is into the foregoing context that I wish to place a discussion of the climactic event of the backslider, Frank's vision of the cowboy Jesus. As the novel approaches its finish, as I said, Frank is bent upon atoning for his unquenchable appetites through shedding his own blood. I attempted to infuse these final pages with suspense, apparently with too much success, since a number of readers informed me that seeing no way out for Frank, they had continued their reading with only the greatest of discipline. I had known from my earliest thoughts about writing this novel that I wanted my protagonist to be saved by the offer of an unconditional grace. I did not see until very late in the process of writing the novel just how that offer should be depicted. An epiphany of some sort seemed to be in order because Frank is consistently shown to be a believer in spiritual manifestations. And in fact, he conceives of his ascetic regimen as communicated to him through several dark visions. I came upon the cowboy Jesus in an almost accidental way. On a couple of occasions, Mary Ann informs Frank that she has had a recurring daydream in which, being lost, she is rescued by a rider who turns out to be Jesus in the regalia of a cowboy. Late in the writing process, as I sought to conceive of an epiphany that would seem plausible, given the tone and characterization up to this point, it occurred to me that Mary Ann's whimsical daydream could serve as an intense reality for Frank. The vision comes to Frank in the restroom of the Panguitch North Ward Church, where he, having just baptized Mary Ann a Mormon, has gone to change from his wet clothes. In fact, the vision occurs just as Frank flushes the urinal he has used. At this moment, the restroom fades from sight, and Frank sees a horseman approaching through a thicket of junipers. And so I will read from the novel. Coming close, the horseman halted and lifted a hand. It was Jesus, his face as kind as an August dawn. "You're lost," he said. Ashamed, Frank cast his eyes downward. "I expect I am." "You're feeling awfully bad," Jesus said. "It's not much of anything." "It isn't any bother," Jesus said. "Hearing your griefs is my business. Go ahead and tell me." The rider pushed back his Stetson and cocked a leg over the saddle horn. The roan blinked sleepy eyes and swished his tail. "My grandmother lost 4 babies and went crazy in the sandhills," Frank said. "I'm sorry about that." "My little sister Elizabeth died and my mother can't get over it." "I know," Jesus said. "Your family is a sad one." "My dad died when I was 10. "That's tough," Jesus agreed. "Also, my brother cut himself off. He took a hunting knife and laid waste to his privates. Now he thinks he's a little girl named Alice. This afternoon he dug himself a pit and sat in it. He said he was waiting for the ladder of Lazarus. He's pure as an angel. He can't sin no matter what." "The poor crazy devil," Jesus said. "The thing I feel worst about is I can't live righteously," Frank said. "I've got a wife I can't leave alone. I make love to her all the time. I'm cunning and devilish about thinking up new ways to do it, too. I hate healthy, decent food. I love ham and broiled steaks and pie and ice cream. I wish I had my shiny blue pickup back and my gelding and my boots and jeans and pearl button shirts. I wish I had my deer rifle back so I could go deer hunting. I wish I could take my wife trout fishing. Jesus pulled a sack of Bull Durham from his shirt pocket and was rolling a cigarette. I thought smoking was against the word wisdom, Frank said. It is. How come you're smoking? I suppose it's a little habit I've got into. I hope you won't take it up. No, sir. That isn't one of my inclinations. Good. Now go on with your story. I hate to say this. The worst thing is I hate God. The writer raised his eyebrows, but he didn't speak. I love the world, Frank said. I love my wife and my little kid that hasn't been born yet. And I love a big truck under me, and I love sunrise out over the Escalante Breaks, and I love the sound of the diesels running the pumps in the middle of the night. That's what I love. I hate God. Well, I'm sorry to hear that. Myself, I love God. I know you do. Well, go on now. There isn't much more to say, except I scraped all the skin off the back of my hand. It's in my mind to do the same to myself as Jeremy did to himself. Except when I cut myself off, there won't be anybody around to stop the bleeding. Why can't you believe my blood was enough? Jesus said. Why do you have to shed yours too? I don't know, Frank said. There's a lot of crazy in your family. Yes, sir, I know it. Furthermore, that Marianne is one hell of a good woman. Why don't you just settle down and enjoy her like a husband would who had some good sense? You think I ought to? Yeah, you ought to. Jesus crushed the cigarette on the sole of his boot. He pulled his leg down off the saddle horn and said, I've got to ride. It was good to chat with you. Yes, sir. Thank you, sir. Jesus pulled on buckskin gloves and took up the reins. If you want to eat that damn vegetable diet of your mother's all your life, don't blame me for it. Myself, I go for food that tastes good. Yes, sir, I'll remember that. Do something to make your poor mother-in-law feel better. Your wife getting baptized a Mormon has been tough on her. Yes, sir, I will, sir. You go see a doctor with that hand, you bet. Jesus pulled his horse around and struck him lightly in the ribs with his spurs. Looking back, he said, and work on that crap about hating God. See if you can get over it. Yes, sir, I sure will, Frank said. The vision of the cowboy Jesus is mentioned in almost any discussion of my novel. A non-Mormon friend who had his honors class at Ball State University in Indiana read the book reported that his students called the vision a stroke of genius. None of them were Mormon. Mormon readers have expressed strong approval of the vision, but other Mormon readers have expressed equally strong disapproval. Among Mormons, as I said earlier, the vision appears to generate controversy. Two very dear friends, both respected professors of English at BYU, show opposite reactions in published articles. Eugene England, in an essay review published in BYU Studies, writes, "That vision is one of the most lovely and believable epiphanies I have encountered in modern fiction. It is the capstone to an extraordinary achievement, not only in thematic content that is seriously theological, but in form that is meticulously crafted to give permanent being to that content." Of different spirit is Richard Craycroft. In a presidential address delivered to the Association for Mormon Letters, Craycroft calls on Mormon literary critics to eschew what he defines as a sophic understanding based upon science and reason, and to embrace a mantic understanding based on faith and the witness of the Holy Spirit. England's review of the backslider says Craycroft is a typical example of the sophic creeds of secularism at work. Citing England's statement quoted above, Craycroft writes, "My own sophic literary sensibilities cheer England's testimonial. The backslider is true and faithful to a sophic and secular vision of literature. But my mantic sensibilities recoil, as have so many Latter-day Saint readers, who are shocked by this profanation of Christ, as they are by the grotesque God of Frank's strange, quasi-Calvinistic, but decidedly not LDS theology." In a recent Association for Mormon Letters list posting via the internet, Craycroft spoke of the Cowboy Jesus episode as the vision of our Lord of the Urinal. This appellation, the vision of our Lord of the Urinal, is one I willingly accept. It is a pleasant irony that one day, quite by accident, Craycroft and I found ourselves side by side at the urinals in the downtown ZCM store in Salt Lake City, where we exchanged cordial words about the backslider. It's one of those ironies of circumstance. The AML list is a moderated discussion of Mormon literature on the Internet, co-sponsored by the Association for Mormon Letters and Weber State University. As may be gathered from my mention of it above, subscribers have from time to time discussed the backslider, resulting in what might be called a minor debate over the propriety and effectiveness of the vision of the cowboy Jesus. The hardworking moderator of the AML list, Benson Parkinson, has written about what he tactfully terms the restroom epiphany. Parkinson interprets the unorthodox circumstances of the vision as an enablement of the non-Mormon reader, who will accept the verisimilitude of such a vision more readily. And quoting, "The unexpectedness of the location, the fact that Christ speaks in the vernacular, that he smokes, all this strikes me as the author winking his eye, saying, this isn't serious, and because it isn't, you, as an educated worldly reader, have permission to take it seriously." In a later posting, Parkinson repeats his perception that I am writing for an audience beyond the circle of the faithful. Saying he is not offended by the comedy and nose-tweaking of the vision, he identifies it with magical realism, where the reader is willing to accept an impossible version of reality. This, writes Parkinson, quote, is to naturalize it for the non-believing audience, but a vision naturalized for unbelievers is a vision without any fundamental power. Parkinson's insights remind me that, in fact, while writing The Backslider, I did conceive of my audience as a mixture of liberal Mormons and sympathetic Gentiles who might be interested in how a young Mormon man who has internalized some of the fringe lunacies of the Mormon faith is rescued by an application of a traditional concept of grace. I can't say that I thought of myself as writing strictly for the unfaithful, because I know many, many liberal Mormons who are devout believers. However, I understood from the beginning that my novel would not appeal to the large majority of Mormons. I was aware in engaging in what Parkinson aptly calls nose-tweaking, an endeavor that is perhaps to be judged as futile, since the large majority of Mormons will never read the book and their noses will remain forever untweaked. Some contributors to the AML list declare themselves undeterred by the comic aspects of the vision of the cowboy Jesus. And quoting, "When it gets to the part where Jesus says, 'Why can't you believe my blood was enough? Why do you have to shed yours too?'" writes Michael Austin, "I was choking back tears and taking every word dead seriously." Austin later posted a brief treatise on why he considered the backslider to be authentically Mormon in its advocacy of the concept of grace. Writes Austin, "Basically, the paradox of Mormon identity is this. The most central elements of Mormon theology are the atonement of Jesus Christ and the reality of God's grace. However, these are also the most central elements of Catholicism, Protestantism, Orthodoxy, and almost every other Christian religion. That which makes us most essentially ourselves, therefore, is also that which fails to distinguish us from others. And it has been my observation for some time that in order to compensate for this paradox, ordinary rank-and-file Mormons often attempt to represent themselves as believers in an authoritarian, works-oriented theology that has nothing whatsoever to do with the Church's real teachings. The vital concept of grace, which should be at the center of any Mormon's religious vocabulary, has often become an unfortunate casualty in our attempts to construct ourselves as a unique and peculiar people." End of quote. Unquestionably, Austin takes a bold stand for a Mormon. For him, it is irrelevant that the cowboy Jesus swears and smokes a cigarette. I feel truly honored that Austin finds my book one that teaches us, quote, that it is possible to create an identifiably Mormon character in an identifiably Mormon novel, while at the same time placing the atonement of Jesus Christ at the center of the work. I am, however, neither surprised nor offended that others on the AML list take exception to a swearing, cigarette-smoking Jesus. Richard Rust summarizes the Orthodox Mormon view of grace as guaranteeing resurrection to all regardless of merit, but offering exaltation upon the condition of the individual's repentance and righteous behavior. With a humorous incisiveness, Rust writes, "The cowboy Jesus with his smoking and profanity does not fit the Jesus in the Book of Mormon, who says, 'That which ye have seen me do, even that ye shall do.' In the backslider, this is reversed. That which I have seen ye do, Peterson's Jesus seems to say to the cowboy, that I shall do. Admittedly, the Jesus of Mormon doctrine could not possibly condone a relaxed attitude toward bad language in the Word of Wisdom. However, another AML list participant maintains that it is not necessary for a fictional Jesus to hew to the model of the doctrinal Jesus. The cowboy Jesus, writes John Bunyan, quote, is a fictional construct designed to achieve certain disturbing narrative effects. Why should a fictional Jesus mimic a doctrinal one? Siding with Rust, another participant, John Binder, quickly replies to Bunyan's question. A fictional Jesus ought to resemble the doctrinal Jesus, says Binder, because the issue with respect to Mormon literature is that if a writer is attempting to teach his or her readers something about a doctrinal issue, such as the atonement, it would be worth, quote, getting it right doctrinally. Yet another participant, Robert Paxton, aligns himself with Bunyan against Rust and Binder. Paxton writes, while on the one hand I want LDS literature to present the truth and the doctrine to the world, or at least the reading public, a part of me also wants to say we can create even extreme and jarring poetic images for the sake of communicating an idea effectively. As a finale to this debate, Robert Starling enters with Rust and Binder in favor of a doctrinally correct Jesus in fiction. Starling takes exception to Michael Austin's position that Latter-day Saints have overemphasized peripheral aspects of the gospel to the neglect of the central doctrine of grace. Starling particularly defends the word of wisdom, which the Lord has given as, quote, a simple measuring rod of our commitment to him, end quote. Authors have failed their Latter-day Saint readership if they undermine the important principles of obedience. Thus concludes Starling, I have problems with a cowboy Jesus who doesn't, along with his forgiveness, say, go and sin no more. So what do I think, these 10 years later, of the cowboy Jesus and of the novel in which he appears? I was greatly flattered when an acquaintance said that the backslider is now a part of the Utah landscape. I would be happy if I had written the novel for which I will be remembered. The odds against it, however, are vast in a civilization where tens of thousands of new novels are published each year. It is impossible to guess all the reasons a reader might have for disliking a novel. Obviously, belief, attitude, and experience condition a reader's aesthetic responses profoundly. What might be called secondary qualities of graphic description and earthy dialogue in The Backslider inevitably repel most Mormon readers. A Mormon physician from California told me by letter that I had, in effect, blasphemed by having Frank, during his backsliding phase, hope that, quote, there was somewhere a fellow could get away from the big son of a bitch in the sky. Writes this physician, were I to rate the book for various categories of consideration, I would give it an A for contemporary fiction, an A for its believable setting in South Central Utah, an A for your development of the various characters involved, a strong B for your introduction and even expounding upon gospel principles, but a rock-bottom F for your desecration of deity. It is possible that I would presently enjoy a wider readership if I had written The Backslider without graphic description and profane dialogue. However, I can scarcely imagine the novel without these qualities. Certainly, I would have had to rein in a good deal of the defiance toward conformity that I felt at the moment of writing the book. Also, the graphic and profane qualities of the novel appeal in a way I could not have foreseen to certain active, faithful Latter-day Saints. More than one person has said to me with some fervor, your novel is the reason I am still a Mormon. I recall my astonishment when about a year after The Backslider first appeared, a Mormon lawyer informed me on the steps of the federal court building in Salt Lake that my novel had been instrumental in reactivating two of his backsliding friends. A little later, a group of women named themselves The Backsliders, as they informed me one evening when they invited me to talk to them about my book. These vivacious, intelligent women were restless and unhappy over the status of women among the Mormons. 7 years following my first visit, these women invited me back to their group. I'm pleased to say they struck me as much more at peace with their faith. I think when they first encountered it, my novel assisted them in their difficult endeavor to remain within the church. Not infrequently, my novel comforts those who love real-life backsliders. At a party one evening, a woman told me she had felt more reconciled to her father's suicide, because after reading The Backslider, she felt hopeful that God would forgive him for killing himself. One correspondent, though she thinks I did an injustice, quote, by portraying every active Mormon as either being senile or fanatical, end quote, finds much good in the backslider. In a letter, she writes, I am an active Mormon. For you to portray Christ as a smoker seemed very sacrilegious. But later I came to the conclusion that we needed that. We need to be aware that the person behind the cigarette can very well be virtuous. He can love his God, his family, and himself. Whether he smokes or doesn't smoke has nothing to do with the kind of man he is inside. I have a son who is an unrepentant Frank. He is a hard worker. He is impetuous. He smokes. He drinks. He sleeps with girls. He has been a heartache for years. Your book helped me look past all of that to the boy inside, and I thank you for that. I must say that a communication of this sort, intimate and reflective, touches me deeply. It makes me feel as if I am playing an active rather than a passive role in Mormonism. The truth is that I see myself as helping a certain kind of Mormon remain Mormon. I did not anticipate this result when I began writing fiction about Mormons, but I rejoice in it nonetheless. Though my fame and influence are obviously to be very modest indeed, they are enough to encourage me to keep writing. As for Frank and the rangeland Jesus, who appears in the nick of time to save him from self-destruction, I really can't think of any other satisfactory way to have given body, drama, and objectivity to the emotions from which they sprang. I am grateful for anyone who reads The Backslider, and I certainly do not resent criticism. As I said, adverse attention is much better than no attention at all. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was very nice. Neil Chandler is here to comment on the paper. I have very little background on Neil, but he is the director of creative writing at Cleveland State University.
That means I push a lot of paper and get to read a book now and again. That's about what that means. Can't see it here. The controversy over the vision of the cowboy Jesus in Levi's novel, The Backslider, has sometimes been waged with me, or between me and certain friends, my wife, around the dinner table in my home. It has not surprised me much. It has, on the other hand, disappointed me a little. First of all, by its utter predictability. Secondly, with the equally predictable avenues of argument into which objections have fallen. And thirdly, on account of the zealousness with which details of the novel are often bulldozed under a mountain of doctrinal road fill. In the forms familiar to me, it seems to be an argument not so much about the cowboy Jesus, nor the characters in the novel, nor the book in general, as an argument about theological decorum. A kind of Sunday school board squabble over what kind of behavior the Almighty Lord of Hosts in this church is to be permitted, and what kind he decidedly is not. Let me confess at the outset that I belong to those readers who were tremendously moved by the amazing redemptive scene at the end of a difficult book. That I have read it several times and never failed to be moved again, to choke up a little and to wish that first and last things were really just like this, though I could not easily have told you what exactly the this in that statement meant. Mind you, I do not believe that being moved is a sure sign of merit or authenticity. After all, I am also often moved by AT&T commercials. After all, I have sometimes fallen fast asleep during teary, heartfelt affirmations in testimony meeting. After all, I have heard powerful stump speakers from BYU's Traveling Education Week cry and even sob on cue, like a good actor in an anniversary performance, primed and honed to portray yet one more time a bosom freshly burning with revelation. As the touchstone of conviction, emotions are everything, but they are also nothing if not dangerous. Still, the emotions generated for me by this book are unlike the push-button emotions of commercials and spiritual stump speeches, hard won. The Backslider is not an easy read. With the exception of Marianne, the central characters, Frank Wyndham, Frank's mother Margaret, his brother Jeremy slash Alice, are painful and embarrassing embodiments of human extremity, who fall far outside the safe suburban spheres of measure and niceness and conservative accommodation which are home to most of our Mormonism. Not unlike a Medea or a Raskolnikov, a Captain Ahab or a Faustian Adrian Levakun, they stray far beyond the norms of the culture which produced them. They are over the top, a little or even a lot crazy. And because Mormonism is so central to the novel, is right up front, for Mormons these over-the-top characters are as unnerving as rogue relatives who have gone fundamentalist, have taken extramarriage partners to their pious bosoms, have taken assault weapons and distilled water, camouflage gear, and excessive stores of chemical fertilizer into their basements. To read about such characters is not unlike listening to public discussions of Danites and Blood Atonement, of political kingdoms of God and theocratic monarchy, of wily polyandrous polygyny. All of these extremes are varieties of Mormon wildness to which you and I have been far too religiously domesticated, not to say housebroken, ever to be a party. I know there are many upset with a heavenly vision emergent from a urinal, rushing waters of a urinal. It's evident that many cannot abide a deity who curses and breaks the word of wisdom. I would also dare to venture that, though this remains unspoken, most don't much like his weariness Stetson either, nor riding a sleepy-eyed roan. The truth is, we like our Jesuses the old-fashioned way, white-robed, sandal-clad, Scandinavian. This vision is fixed in our religious art, our publications, our minds, our mythology. A Jesus with short, black, curly hair, a Mediterranean complexion, a Jewish nose. Let's face it, even a Jesus in a dark general authority suit and red tie and male pattern baldness would be embarrassing. And hey, the New Testament Jesus, who hung out with street rabble and sinners, who cheated the Sabbath, profaned deity, declined to hate Israel's occupying enemies, was a thorn and embarrassment to those good persons who were more than willing to embrace a proper, decorous, and adequate Messiah. If you think about it, this same New Testament Jesus has proven an embarrassment even to us Latter-day Saints. We want our gods narrowly Hellenic, which is to say Platonic and traditional, which is to say we want them pure, free of idiosyncrasy, failing or foible, any taint of experience, any and all suggestion of personality. We do not want a personal God to embarrass us by getting or being personal. Even friends of the cowboy Jesus see his personal qualities as a kind of playful decertification. He becomes a specially fictional creation, a good thing, but something altogether different from and not to be confused with a heavenly creator. Or hobbled by personality, he becomes better human in company because he has become all too human. Sort of like Samson with his haircut, charmingly muscular, with a quaint history and good tales to tell, but harmless nonetheless. Where, however, is the God become human? Where is the God revealed to Joseph Smith in Liberty Jail, who had descended below all of Joseph's trials and hard, compromising human experience? Levi says that the turning point in this novel is hinged on unconditional grace, and that is implicit when the cowboy Jesus asks Frank why his own blood will not suffice. That, however, is the only gesture at theology in the scene. Jesus speaks neither of condemnation nor of forgiveness. He neither requires behavior nor absolves Frank from the need to change behavior. Mostly he listens. It's his job, he says. He empathizes, makes suggestions. He speaks as someone who knows sorrow and tragedy and craziness and personal error. He is sorry. He doesn't fix things, clean them up, doesn't justify or explain them. He's just trying to help Frank rise above them, trying to be a friend, a counselor, a brother. For me, the astringent requirements of perfection, degrees of moral tidiness, seem as relevant here as recipes for Lysol or instructions for achieving laboratory asepsis. Is it so beyond imagination that the God of this world should be deeply, inextricably, even embarrassingly in it? The cowboy Jesus advises Frank to enjoy his wife, his food, his life as best he can, to help his offended mother-in-law, to forgive God the heartbreak and the craziness in his family, and to forgive him as well the heartbreaking allure and beauty of the world. If you can think of better, more spirited, more deeply Mormon advice, I'd like to hear it. This is perhaps not the omnipotent, world-renouncing voice of Pauline Christianity, nor is it the spare, angry voice Frank Wyndham had expected to hear, but rather the world-wearied, world-invested, powerful yet bounded voice of King Follett theology. What could be more Mormon? When I was a missionary, I was cornered one day by a beautiful young woman, neighbor to the woman we were teaching, who had suddenly seized upon the notion that these foreign missionaries and this new religion might be her salvation. She sat us down and told us what to me then was a harrowing tale. She was, we learned, a kept woman, kept by two or three or maybe even more men. I could never get the count straight. These were, as you might expect, married men, but they were also the sole source of support for her and a five-year-old son. She was far too beautiful ever to have learned to rely on anything beyond her beauty for support. She lived comfortably, but the arrangement had hurt and embittered her lesbian lover, the true love of her life, as she told me, the only lover who had not purchased her nor ever tried to exploit her. This circumstance was tearing her apart, and her desperation spilled over into what seemed to me clearly an unhealthily physical and obsessive relationship with her bewildered little boy. I was 20 years old. My companion and I dutifully gave her the lessons, but she seemed somehow far beyond consternation over the unfortunate multiplying of Christian denominations in the world, or even over the loss of a foundation of prophets and apostles in the primitive church. The oh-so-carefully veiled admonishment to chastity in the sixth and final lesson seemed to affect her as I imagine a puff of nasal spray might affect a blazing forest. She was desperate, burning. We were stumped, out of our depth, out of resources. I asked the mission president for counsel, and he instructed us, soundly no doubt, to run, not walk, to the nearest exit. We did so. We escaped, or abandoned, you can pick your verb here, this desperate, exquisite woman, her extremity, her insatiable vulnerability. But I was struck then, and have sometimes since been struck, by what I will have to call the fastidious wussiness of my one and only true religion in the face of great pain and real extremity. This, too, has seemed a source of some embarrassment. I wish today that instead of me with my companion and six memorized lessons, that desperate young woman in Hamburg had encountered something much more like Levi's novel. What she got was good intentions and sound, correlated doctrines. What she needed was a cowboy Jesus. Thank you.
There are about 8 minutes left. If there are questions of either Neil or Levi, I'm sure they'd be willing to answer them. Or does anyone have any questions?
My name is Lamar Timothy, and this question is directed to Levi. I'm an outsider. I'm an engineer. The joke that goes along with that is an engineer was passing through a forest, and on a path was a frog, and he picked it up, and the frog said, "Give me a kiss, and I'll turn into a princess, and we can fall in love and marry and live happily ever after." And the engineer just put the frog in his pocket, and the frog says, "Oh, come on, give me a kiss." And the engineer said, "Well, heavens, I'm an engineer. I don't have time for romance, but I always wanted a talking frog." but as I understand creative writing and that sort of thing, it can be, it's always fiction. And then that might break down, I'm analyzing now, that might break down into something like therapy or romantic or entertainment or something like that. But often there's a moral message in there. And as I read some of Levi's writings, so to me they were sort of therapeutic and romantic and entertaining. But on the moral issue, I think Neil referred to that as being dangerous. And for me, his literature wasn't dangerous, but his writing wasn't dangerous. But for a younger person, maybe it is dangerous. That is, the Bible could be viewed as dangerous literature in that it might change one's moral behavior or something of that nature. Now, my question to Levi is, what are your real intentions here? To be entertaining, therapeutic, or dangerous?
Well, I would say all of those. A novel ought to entertain. And I suppose if I had gone forward with a very sober backslider, it might have been entertaining. I hope it's even more entertaining for having a fair infusion of the comic in it. And I am startled sometimes to meet people who find it only comic. They will talk at great length about the comic aspects of it, which are there. Therapeutic, right? I would hope that would have that quality. The dangerous part, I suppose, I wrote the book with a certain degree of defiance, because I'm offended by the counters of good deeds. Those who are going to earn their salvation by counting their good deeds. And I think that's a fault that the Latter-day Saints have in a great excess. And it would please me to have a fellow Mormon catch the spirit of what Neil has alluded to, and what Michael Austin alluded to, and Gene England, that the centrality of Christianity is the free gift of salvation. And that has an awfully lot of meaning. But I don't know how you're going to avoid disturbing people. I assume that's what correlation is about, to reduce disturbance as much as possible. And a simple letter from an irate student at BYU produces a great rush of, you know, memos intended to quiet and calm and so on. Merely being alive exposes you to dangerous ideas unless you encircle yourself with a total fence of no ideas. And I guess I would feel bad to have the backslider ruin testimonies. I know a young man who wrote me a fine letter praising me for it, later committed suicide. I doubt that the novel had any influence on his suicide, but certainly a novel isn't going to save somebody. Neil, do you have anything you want to reply to on the question of the dangers of writing frank and candid literature?
My question is, what were your intentions when you wrote it? To be dangerous?
Well, no. Were my intentions to be dangerous? No, I think not. The nose tweaking, yes. I would be pleased to have certain kinds of readers say, "Oh, shit, what are you trying to do, Peterson?" Yeah, that kind of reader ought to be you know, not injured but irritated. Yeah, I don't mind doing that. Other questions?
Please.
I think one thing some people might find threatening and disturbing, not just the Cowboy Jesus part, but throughout the novel, runs a reverence for detail for this kind of life and some of the protestings we're alluding to and some of the details of living in that kind of environment. And it just seems very non-transcendent, very earthbound, very earthly, and there seems there's a lot of reverence for those kind of earthly, holy details. And in a way, I think some could read it as a critique of the very kind of spiritual life that is focused on the transcendent, focused on the hereafter, at the expense of everyday life. And can you imagine yourself drawing a character, maybe give me an example, Neil, or whichever, of characters who could focus on the transcendent and still get the most.
Good. Neil, come answer that, but repeat the question as best you can for the microphone.
Well, you pressed one of my hot buttons here. I'm sorry. The question had to do with the focus in the novel. It's quite wonderful focus on the mundane and ordinary details of life, this kind of rural life, and that is very, very strongly, very clearly, very physically evoked for us. And Frank Wyndham is somebody who tells us in the passage that Levi read that he loves life. He loves working on a shed, gets caught up in it for 3 and 4 hours at a time, feels guilty because he forgets to think about God. And what I this is a kind of schizophrenia in Mormonism. We have this fundamental belief that we came into this life to have the experience of a physical body and a physical world, and that this was progress. It was a good thing. We have to do it in order to be, what, celestial beings. And then we spend our time deciding that, of course, while we're in it, it's bad. Because the really good things were what we used to have, which was spiritual life. And if we could only get ahead to spiritual life, which is in fact back there somewhere, we'd be getting somewhere. We have to decide what we want and what we believe. The belief should somehow be that there's something about this life, this physical life, which has something in common with celestial or perfected life that's important and positive and good. And if we spend our time being spiritual, denigrating physical life, with Paul, of course, in the New Testament, who does that, then what's the point? Is this some colossal celestial joke that God is having with us? And why do we talk out of both sides of our mouths about this? The beautiful thing about this novel, and I think the religious moment in this novel, is its concern with this life, this world, this existence, the now, and being in the now. And what the cowboy Jesus tries to offer to Frank Wyndham is a reverence for that, a sense of the holy in this love that he already has. That's one of the things I love most about this book. It seems to be one of the few moments in Mormon literature where that dichotomy, that sort of schizophrenia in Mormon thinking, is overcome. So, hey, what's the problem? And I understand the question, but I don't see, at least in terms of Mormon thinking and Mormon theology, what the problem is.